Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program made possible through underwriting for a Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. It's no secret that the 2016 presidential election is one of the most unusual and often contentious in recent history. KCBX, along with NPR member stations, is participating in Collaboration for a Nation Engaged, with the shared mission to provide information and conversation vital to our decisions as effective citizens. Today, we'll be taking a deeper look at the question, what is America's place in the world? My guests for the discussion in alphabetical order are Alfred J. Fonzie II, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army, retired, who has over 36 years military service at various posts in intelligence, infantry, armor, and special forces units. He's a former chief of counterintelligence and human intelligence in Bosnia, holds a master's degree in international relations from the University of Southern California, and is recognized by the state of California as a specialist in counterterrorism, disaster management, and other issues related to homeland security. Shelley L. Hurt is associate professor at Cal Poly Science Department. She specializes in international relations, science and technology policy, and American political development. She's conducted extensive archival research in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and at the Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan presidential libraries. Robert Schaefer, who has for many years been a journalist for nonprofit and environmental organizations, has also authored 10 books on global problems and has written extensively about partition and war, globalization, democratization, women and work, environmental issues, social movements, and global social change. He's on the faculty at Cal Poly as a senior sociology scholar. Today, our show is live, and we invite you to join our conversation, and you can do that really easily by calling in with questions at area code 805-781-3875. Again, if you live in the 805, it's 781-3875. And I want to welcome all of you today.
Thank you for being here with me.
So, boy, this is huge. Huge topic to kind of go into of what America's place in the world is. And, you know, something that I keep hearing is the term American exceptionalism. And so I'm wondering if maybe that's a place that we could start, about what the definition of that is, because it's been bantered about, you read about it, and I'm not so sure that we really understand sometimes what that means and how that even feeds into some decisions about our place globally.
Well, in my contemporary U.S. foreign policy class, I teach the students that American exceptionalism has a particular kind of origin story, and it has to do with how the American political experience differs from those on the European continent, because we never had a left party. And so we never had any parties that were specifically on the left, because we don't have the historical antecedents that they do on the European continent. And so American exceptionalism kind of comes from that historical perspective, but today it's been appropriated more to think about American greatness.
Okay.
When I think of American exceptionalism, I think of the fact that the United States was the first republic in the modern world. In 1800, there was only one. And now most of the 195 countries around the world are republics. And by that, I mean it's based on constitutional government, popular sovereignty, and, you know, with an aspiration towards democracy and citizenship and so on. So the United States started off as extremely exceptional and unique in the world and among states. The interesting thing is now is that exceptionalism has become widely shared. That is to say, most countries around the world think of themselves as republics. There's a few kingdoms left, but not many. And most of them aspire to democracy, and there's been a wave of democratization. So to some extent, the world is becoming more American, and we are less exceptional in that regard. And that's, I think, a good thing.
Al?
I look at it a little differently. To me, American exceptionalism exceptionalism relates more to the idea of being in America. It's not just being a place. It's not having a king or a queen or anything like that. It's not being loyal to a personality. And it's one of the few countries in the world where the individual is elevated above the state, and that's enshrined in our Constitution and our traditions. And I always remember my grandmother, who immigrated from Italy, talking to my grandfather. He says, "Ashen, speak English. You're an American now." You know, and that's the idea. It was in their head. You know, they had the traditional dinners and many things that you do from the old country, but they strove to be identified, self-identified as an American, because that was an idea in their mind as much as anything else.
Does some of the concept of our role in exceptionalism have to do with what we should be doing with other countries?
I think so. I think the United States, plays a leading role in working to build, to expand the republics, to decolonize the world, to engage in collective security and defense through the United Nations and institutions like NATO. And so I think the United States has a powerful role to play. And let me just say, too, that we're not just talking about government, but citizens and NGOs and so on, from Oxfam to the Sierra Club the French Ferdinand Doctors Without Borders, and non-governmental organizations and individual citizens, religious groups and so on have also taken American ideas and values and economic resources and gone around the world and worked with people and engaged people in that way too, and that's an important role that citizens play at below the level of state diplomacy and so on.
But I think there is a little bit more controversy today, and that's kind of bubbling up in the election right now, about the pendulum always swings in American political discourse between expansionism and engagement versus kind of isolationism. Mm-hmm. And we see this playing out in the presidential campaign right now. And we are living through a really fascinating historical moment because the world is based on U.S. power, U.S. dominance. It's what we call in political science a unipolar world. And that has a lot of implications because it means that security and prosperity is based upon U.S. primacy and engagement in the world. And yet at the same time, if something goes wrong, the U.S. is blamed and has to take responsibility in a sense. And so that kind of conflict is something that's playing out domestically and internationally for the U.S. right now.
My experiences are a little different, I think. It's mostly how other people see us. I think most people, at least since the Second World War and perhaps even after the First World War, saw Americans as protectors and as the good guys and as fair and as honest brokers in conflicts. An example I have is when I was in Bosnia. I had a Humvee full of soldiers hit head-on by a semi-truck on one of their narrow roads, the wide part like Highway 41 up towards Morro Bay. And they were sent end over end through a minefield down a 600-foot to a 600-foot ravine, a valley. And I had to go down there and see how my soldiers were doing, which was interesting, working your way through a minefield in the first place to do that. And I got down to the bottom. I couldn't find my soldiers. They were gone. And what had happened is the local village of Ilovo came. They worked their way. They knew where the mines were. They came through, lifted my soldiers out one by one, carried them hand over hand out of the field, took them to the local hospital. When I got there, I talked to them. And the local villager said, "You're Americans. You're here to help us. We know that, and we love you for it. If you were Germans, we would have killed you." Because their memory is long.
This was in 1997,
yes,
was it?
It was on Ilovo grade, 1997. And that's how a lot of people see us. And I've been deployed in peacekeeping missions as well as in wars. I never had a child run away screaming because they saw American soldiers coming. Never.
And now?
Not now either. I mean, it's been a long time. It's been 10 years since I've been in the service. Mm-hmm. But even when I was in Iraq, I didn't have that problem. People looked at us much differently. The villagers did. They looked at us as protectors and people that came to help. Our soldiers liked kids, and they showed it. But in all the times I've been there, I've never saw children run from us. They always ran to us because they knew that nothing else American soldiers would protect them. So it makes a difference.
It is a different perspective.
It is. And most Americans, unless you travel a lot, you don't usually see that. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. So disasters, who's the first one there with aid? A lot of times Americans of any stripe, whether military or civilians, you know, we are there for the world. We've been there as long as we've been a modern country, we've been there. So,
what do you think about that, Robert?
Oh, I think it's actually, I think it's pretty true. There's the United States incurs hostility and from different people in different parts of the world, or is used as a way to rally people in a cause by differentiating themselves from others and Americans and so on. But I think generally people around the world are pretty positive about the United States, and I think the if you go abroad, I think that isn't that your experience when you go abroad?
Yeah, definitely.
And that's been, people look to and admire the United States. And part of it, what I'm trying to say is it's partly a legacy. It's something that the United States has been working on for 200 years, in a sense, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and we still reap some of the, I don't say dividends, but we're getting mileage out of it. Those things have enduring qualities and they're ongoing. Now, that's not to say there's not difficulties in the world. I mean, there are a lot of serious problems and animosities, though most of the animosities are local or they're regional. They're between different groups and different, we were talking about this earlier,
yeah,
different people in different parts of the world. The people in the Middle East have, many peoples there have a much greater antagonism toward their neighbors than they do to Americans or Russians or French or something like that.
Do you think that there is an element of it's being touted as being much more horrible than it is? Or
I think
is the world as scary a place as we're led to believe by media, by what is focused on?
If you're talking about the world's a lot more scary than the media is telling you right now. But if you're talking about America and how people see it, we've never had to build a wall to keep our people in, and people still come to this country swimming through shark-infested waters, whatever. They'll risk their lives to get here.
And they do.
And they come by the tens of thousands every day.
Yes.
No other country in the world has that problem, to my knowledge.
That's right.
Yeah,
I think there is a misperception, generally speaking, among Americans that America is in decline and has lost a lot of stature and influence in the world. And I think empirically that's incorrect. I mean, the U.S. is as influential positively and as powerful as it's as ever been in all these different categories. And so I think it's a real misperception, and it's infecting the campaign about this idea of American decline. It's just really not true.
One of the things that I was reading is that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have different views on America's role in the world, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And in a April 27th speech, Trump had said that his foreign policy would be to always put the interests of American people and America's security first. Clinton, on the other hand, said June 13th that she believes the future holds far more opportunities than threats if we exercise creative and confident leadership that enables us to shape global events rather than be shaped by them. Along with that, in general, Americans had indicated in a U.S. position poll, a Gallup poll, that 63% of them had a negative view of the U.S. position in the world, mm-hmm, as of 2014. So, that it really seems like it's all very conflicting. What do you think that's about?
Well, I think Joseph Nye, who's a professor of political science at the Harvard Kennedy School, he has a recent book on the future of power, and in it he says that every 10 years or so since World War II, the U.S. goes through a period of thinking that the U.S. is in decline. After the missile gap, and after Sputnik in 57, and then Japan in the 80s, the 70s with the oil crisis, and he just kind of shows how every decade this is a recurring
pattern.
So
it's cyclical.
He says, yeah, it's cyclical, and he says it says more about psychology than it says about reality. And I think that that's a great thing for us to remember, because for some reason Americans have this tendency to kind of go hit rock bottom in a sense, and it's maybe a source of renewal and dynamism for the body politic that it seems to have to go through this moment. The presidential election right now is very, very contentious, and
mm-hmm.
so it's debatable whether or not that's a healthy development or not. But as a general phenomenon, I think you can say that it's been good for the country.
Well, let's talk about whether that's a healthy development, because it seems like there's a lot of information that's half information that comes out that people aren't necessarily vetting. In terms of, what do you think about the contentiousness and the messages that are being put out? Is it harmful or is it good? Is it useful?
Well, it reminds me actually more of the 70s and the contention in the presidential campaigns and the elections of the late 60s and early 70s, which were quite acrimonious. Though it felt like, I think, more was at stake then, in some ways than
you
today
were
in terms of the in terms of the war and so on. Whereas that's not the case here. I mean, one of the interesting things is that the United States, the Great Recession and stuff, took a terrible toll on the United States, as it did many countries around the world, and was very nearly a great, Great Recession. But people were worried about a Great Depression. And yet, both the Bush and then the Obama administrations engaged in a bailout and then a stimulus package that, the United States is growing, it's recovered the employment losses, there's economic growth, and so on. Europe, which did the bailout but not the stimulus, is stuck. Other countries are going backwards. So actually, the United States had done very well by comparison, but that doesn't mean that people are happy. And I think there's, people are wrestling with, well, how do you go forward from that experience? I think economically, the United States is probably better than, a lot better than Trump portrays.
The world's a lot different than it was in the 70s, to be sure. I remember Desert One and disaster in Iran, the hostage rescue mission. I remember the Vietnam War because I was in it, and that whole period. But people felt bad in the 70s. After Saigon fell and they saw communist tanks running through the presidential palace's gates, and they'd been through 10 years of war, which tore this country apart, and people were feeling depressed about a lot of things. A movie called Rocky came out, and everybody started feeling good again. And I think that's what's happening now. Then people who invest in the stock market have done very well in the last 7 years. Mm-hmm. But the middle class and the working class, and particularly the working poor, have not done well. And some of them are losing ground. Mm-hmm. The average household is feeling really pressed, which affects their impressions on everything else. Mm-hmm. If you're not doing well personally, I don't care how many times you say, hey, the economy's booming, things are wonderful, they're not feeling it.
It's not yours.
It's not ours at all. And then you have other things that are happening that are being highlighted, like watching American sailors being forced to kneel with their hands up last January and did not do a lot for Americans. Americans don't like to see our colors running or surrendering. They hate it. Mm-hmm. That's part of their DNA, I guess. They like to win. Mm-hmm. And when they see things like that, a total humiliation, that just emphasizes that much more. Things aren't right. Something's wrong. And they begin to listen to other voices at that point.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I'm concerned about the growth of inequality and its, impact on American perceptions and, its real impact on the body politic, because it's since the political parties and the institutions of the government are not responding to this issue that's been ongoing and really getting worse, then it gives rise to kind of these xenophobic, scapegoating issues that we see happening in the presidential campaign. And so I'm concerned about what the outcome or implications of this can be if the political parties can't address this, forthrightly.
You are listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX, your public radio station. If you just joined us, our discussion today centers around the question, what's America's place in the world? My guests are Alfred J. Fonzie, second, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army, retired, with over 36 years military experience, former Chief of Counterintelligence and Intelligence in Bosnia, and recognized by the state of California as a specialist in counterterrorism, disaster management, and other issues related to homeland security. Shelley Hurt associate professor at Cal Poly Political Science Department and specializes in international relations, science and technology policy, and American political development. And Robert Schaefer, a longtime journalist who's also authored 10 books on global problems. He's on faculty at Cal Poly as senior sociology scholar, where he teaches classes on comparative societies, international political economy, and social movements and organizations. Today's show is live, and we invite you to call and join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can call in by calling 805-781-3875. And if you don't feel like calling, but you want to post a thought, you can post it to the National Engaged at hashtag ANationEngaged, and that's the hashtag to use. And we were talking about, you know, you mentioned something a few minutes ago that I wanted to go back to, Al. You were talking about military and, you know, the in terms of the safety of whether or not militarily we are ready or safe, or where our role is with that, and that we're really not as safe or able to avoid anything here as we think. What did you mean by that?
Well, military is in free fall in terms of readiness, combat readiness, and where it's at strategically in terms of our national deterrent forces, nuclear weapons. That has been either frozen or in steady decline, and one expert after the other has come out and protested the proposed policies or the actual policies of this administration and previous administrations and what's happening. First duty of a president is to protect the nation from physical destruction. And unfortunately, there are forces being garnered in the world that are building up and basically pose an existential threat to the survival of the nation. And in a couple of years, that's going to be the case. Within 10 years, China will have a formidable capability. Iran will be a viable nuclear power. North Korea will be a viable power. And by that, I mean they have the ability to deliver weapons. And Russia is modernizing at a pace that has caused multiple general officers and senior intelligence officials to sound all kinds of alarms. And yet we're still going ahead with strategic arms limitations projects or treaties that will put us at a distinct disadvantage. In the Cold War, we had one opponent, the Soviet Union. Within 10 years, we'll be facing four nuclear-armed, very belligerent opponents on the world stage with a declining economy or a shaky economy at best and no real ability to rebound like we have in the past and perhaps no time either.
And so you're saying despite the amount of money that's spent on military and despite the focus on that, it's not enough.
Well, it's not being spent correctly. There's a lot of waste in the military, and its priorities get skewed. But I'll read you some statistics. I can tell you right now, 70% of the military has been cut since the end of the first Gulf War. And just last month, 60% reduction in forces since the sequester came into effect or since Obama came to power. Two-thirds of the Army is rated not combat ready. Only two of 32 infantry brigades are considered deployable. They had a fighter squadron, Marine Aviation Wing, deploying to the Middle East last month. Only two of 14 of their F-18 fighters were capable of being deployed. They had to cannibalize parts from other units. And flight time for pilots has been reduced from 15 hours a month to probably no more than two. And what that equates to, if you get into combat, not only do you have inability to surge, your pilots are going to get blown out of the sky because the abilities of the enemy and their forces and their equipment is comparable to our own. And we will lose our edge, which is one of the things we have, is a qualitative edge, and that is diminishing rapidly.
Yeah, I don't think that's accurate.
Go ahead, Shelley.
I disagree with that perspective. I think that the world is not as dangerous as it was during the Cold War, when you had mutually assured destruction. You had really an existential crisis for the U.S., and today we have non-state actors in asymmetric warfare, but they don't have the capabilities of carrying out something on the level of nuclear Armageddon that the U.S. and the Soviet Union were faced with. And I think that the U.S. is in much better shape, and I do think that we spend a lot of money on the military, and even though some of it is wasted, as the lieutenant said, I still think that there's plenty to make us, you know, we're 100 times more powerful militarily than the next 12 countries combined.
I would say I don't worry so much about the I do worry about nuclear warfare, but my concern with nuclear warfare and nuclear weapons is not great power nuclear rivalries. It's nuclear arms which are held by belligerents that go to war regularly. So India and Pakistan now both have nuclear weapons, and Israel and and its neighbors are trying to, and it's in these contexts, or the Koreas, where North Korea has been, there's still an armistice in North Korea and stuff, is that they're engaged in ongoing disputes. They have several repeated wars in India and so on. Even the use of limited nuclear war in the Indian subcontinent, would be an unimaginable horror. I think that's actually, to my mind, a little more pressing in terms of the reality or the likelihood of it. And I think we have to work really hard to try to discourage the proliferation of nuclear weapons and curb the antagonisms or settle the antagonisms that that animate people in India and the Middle East.
So, Al, I get back to, because there's a couple of things that we've talked about, the U.S. as a protector, and then there's also the U.S. protecting itself, protecting its own borders. And so what you're talking about in terms of readiness and those kinds of things are military here or military abroad?
It's both. The first things that get cut when you have military cuts in the budget is operations, training, and maintenance. Maintenance is in free fall for all kinds of equipment, all kinds of systems. Training has been radically reduced. And what this causes is when you have a crisis. For instance, after World War II, we were the unchallenged military power and economic power in the world. Within 5 years, we go into Korea. We'd done a massive demobilization. We have an invasion of South Korea by the North. We send a pickup force in Japan, and they're basically overrun. They're basically shooting anti-tank rockets that are bouncing off of Russian-made T-34 tanks. And we are virtually driven off the peninsula of Korea by a third, fourth-rate military power at that time, all because we had not conducted the kind of maintenance, readiness, and training. We weren't prepared for a standing start war. And that cost us 8,000 casualties between July and November of 1950. 8,000 young Americans lost their lives. Similar thing happened in the beginning of World War II. We lost 25,000 men, and we lost 81 ships in a five-month period because we had military inferiority vis-a-vis the Japanese in the Pacific, and we weren't ready. It hit us. And the thing in Korea, it's known as Task Force Smith. Colonel Smith took a group over there. Every Army officer knows that story and what happened. And as for what's happening right now, the relative strength, well, I've got general officer comments. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, former head of the DIA, came out and said just last month, we're facing the most serious existential threat since the Cold War. And these guys' job is to basically assess our readiness. What can we do to make sure that America has the capability for a president to execute his domestic and foreign policy especially? And a lot of that then comes down to an enemy evaluating you. Do you think, can they do it? China's defense expenditures in the last several years have been basically aimed at countering the ability for the United States to intervene against a Chinese operation against Taiwan. In the 1990s, when they made a lot of belligerent noises against Taiwan, President Clinton, Bill Clinton, sent a carrier task group or two through the Straits of Taiwan just to make a point. The Chinese have subsequently developed systems that make it impossible for us to do that again, because if you got into a shooting war, they'd be able to blow us out of the water with the systems they've been deploying. That's the kind of thing that someone who's in the armed forces looks at, and they become very concerned.
And when we talk about what is our role, it comes back to what is our role with that. Is our role to go over and manage other countries?
No, it's not our job to manage them, but we have agreements, for instance, with Ukraine. They gave up their nuclear weapons because we promised to protect them. Well, we're not protecting them. We're not even giving them lethal aid to defend themselves. We now have a token battalion in the western part of Ukraine, which are not going to engage in combat. They're basically a tripwire. But Putin is very belligerent. Just this last week, he's been going through snap check drills again, where he mobilizes several hundred thousand troops, aircraft squadrons, ships. He's doing the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea right now. He's done it before. He mobilizes nuclear weapons battalions. Similar to our operational readiness inspections of Strategic Air Command in the 1950s. In other words, I'm going to war kind of maneuvers, no notice. Usually we talk to each other, we're going to conduct an exercise.
So you're saying that Russia is a threat?
they are definitely a threat, but I think what they're going to see happening, and our generals are saying the same thing, is they're going to take not only Ukraine, they're going to move against the Baltic states and seize the Baltic states when they have the capability and they're convinced we don't have the political will to defend them.
Well, I'm going to take a call here. You were going to say something, Shelley?
Well, there's a big debate in political science.
Absolutely.
About whether or not Russia is the aggressor in Ukraine or it's the U.S. expanding NATO right along the Russian border. And I think the political scientists that side with that probably have a little more weight because the U.S. has been very aggressive in expanding NATO right up into Russia's backyard. And then Russia's
And what is the
responded.
Impact of that?
I mean, if we can imagine during the Cold War, if the Soviet Union were to expand the Warsaw Pact up along the Mexican-U.S. border, right, we would have reacted. And so I think sometimes we don't think about, you know, another state acting rationally in what is a perceived threat.
So you're talking about us infringing or NATO.
Well, NATO's expansion as a perceived threat to another country, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to take a call here from Tom. Tom, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Hi, yes.
Great conversation. Terrific use of the public airwaves.
Oh, great.
A couple of quick points, if I could. Because I'm driving and I want to stay focused on the road as well.
Please do.
I think some of the old models, when we're talking about the role of the United States in a changing world, where sort of a rogue player, one non-state player, can wreak a lot of havoc, some of the old models need to be reexamined. But back to a point you were making earlier about America in decline, for many years in some quarters of the American political environment, we've had people saying the federal government is the problem. Federal government is the problem. And in the last decade, at least, we've seen this intransigent of both parties to really work together and compromise for the common weal. And now we have what we call gridlock. And so we see a sort of self-fulfilled prophecy. On top of people's own economic problems, a government that seems to be insular, out of touch, and incapable of working will give us a sense of some decline at home, though I think our role in the world is perceived in entirely different eyes.
That's a good point. Do you have a response to that?
Yeah, no, I agree.
I
think that the people around the world see the U.S. as still extremely influential and powerful and capable of affecting change in their home countries. A lot of people abroad think that the U.S. domestic election is more important for them than their own elections in their home countries because we still exert so much influence in the world. But I agree with the caller. It's an excellent point that despite that happening on the world stage, at home, we do have a lot of political dysfunction, and that is causing a lot of problems.
Well, and I think one of the problems that you alluded to was the military spending and stuff, and that comes out of a gridlock having to do with tax cuts earlier on, and there's been a gridlock about that. Readiness is partly a function of funding, and there's been an inability to. It used to be that Americans on both parties could cooperate and work together on foreign policy and or military stuff, and that's.
Well, and I wanted to say that one point. I mean, the sequester that has led to military budget decline is not Obama's fault. I mean, it was also the Republican Congress. It was a compromise that they came up with, and so again, it's both parties are at this stalemate, and they're not compromising over what you raised. Smartly at the very beginning about this idea, this concept of the national interest. What is it?
Yeah. So I'm going to let you off the hook, literally, Tom, so you can drive safely.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Great conversation.
Okay. Thanks.
Just as a point, I've been briefing congressional candidates, all Republicans, who've asked, and one of the things I pointed out is the sequester is a bipartisan problem, and you need to end the sequester because it doesn't allow intelligent allocation of monies.
It requires
a MEDEAX approach to the Defense Department, 50% out of everything else, 50% comes out of defense, even though you already had a $500 billion cut programmed in. Mm-hmm. It's wrecking havoc, and the first thing that gets cut, like I said, is maintenance and training and basic operations, and that's the cutting edge. You know, defense contractors are still going to get paid. But the average soldier, quality of life issue, when my wife and I left Germany in the 1990s, what happened to us with the big drawdown after the Gulf War, my wife was standing outside the dental clinic at 5 o'clock in the morning in the rain trying to get one of seven appointments, dental appointments for our kids because those things have been cut. The number of dentists and technicians and such was gone. It really has an impact on the average person serving in the military. the flyer, the guy maintaining things, you can't get parts, things get deferred, and that's not good.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to KCBX, your public radio station at 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas de Paso Robles, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and around the world, streaming at kcbx.org. Alphonse II, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army retired, with over 36 years military experience, is here with us today. Shelley L. Hurt, Associate Professor at Cal Poly Political Science Department, and Robert Schaefer, longtime journalist who also is on faculty at Cal Poly as Senior Sociology Scholar, is here. And we're talking about their thoughts around the question, what is America's place in the world? We'd love for you to add your voice to our discussion today, and you can share your thoughts or questions by calling us at 805-781-3875. And we're going to go here to Bill. Bill, is that you?
Yes.
Hi. Did you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I hope your military expert is still available.
Oh, yeah, he's right here.
I had a question about the idea that I haven't heard broached yet is that maybe the whole paradigm of warfare has changed, and our real threat, especially in Europe, looks like that immigrants have become the true invaders, and we're not defending against tanks and missiles and nuclear weapons, but against thousands and thousands of people invading, and there's no way to stop them. And you know, these people are created by tin-horned dictators who want to drive people that disagree with them out of their countries, and they end up in Turkey and Europe.
So what we want is stability in the world affairs is the optimal environment that American foreign policy prefers to operate in. We don't like chaos in Europe, Asia, or on our borders, and that's a real problem. And it's a complex problem in how you resolve it, being humane, being fair and just, compliant with our own laws, at the same time looking at the realities of what's happening, whether it's in Europe, where it's going to dramatically affect European culture and civilization in the next 50 years versus our own, and how we integrate people into our society in an orderly manner. So they become Americans. They accept the American ideal and think of themselves as Americans.
But why are we spending so much money on aircraft carriers and submarines and nuclear weapons when, you know, all it would take would be educating, you know, people in countries where they would be more satisfied with their own opportunities in their own countries and they'd want to stay there?
You're talking about us giving money to other countries and foreign aid in order to build up their society, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the problem is those countries do not have the same concept of rule of law that we do, and we give them money, and it tends to disappear. That was my experience in Iraq. We gave away billions of dollars in Iraq, and we didn't get a lot for it in terms of infrastructure, and because the officials at the top feel like when we give money to their country, we're giving it to their personal bank account, and it just disappears. You can't fix the world. You can do some things well, but you can't do everything well.
Well, maybe we should have thought about that before we started a war there.
Well, that's probably true. A number of people said that. General Shinseki said it would take 300,000 troops to pacify Iraq, and he was his retirement was announced the next day after he said that mm-hmm. to Congress.
That's true.
Yeah. So, Bill, we're going to continue this discussion, but thank you for your comments.
Okay. Bye.
Did you want to say anything about
well,
that?
Well, I would say a couple of things. I mean, I wouldn't characterize immigrants as invaders, and I would note that many of the immigrants in this country, probably 100,000, are people we invite. They're the brides of guys or husbands, and they're orphan children from China, and we invite them to come and stay and become citizens as a matter of practice. And there are tens, hundreds of thousands of people who come because we invite them. A lot of people in the United States are less enthusiastic about people who volunteer to come as opposed to being chosen by us. But there's a lot of people that we invite to come and stay and have historically for a long time, family members and relatives and so on.
This is another area where I think American exceptionalism really comes in, because when we look at the demographic challenges of the industrialized world, most advanced countries are experiencing a demographic decline right now, an implosion, and the U.S. is the only country that's seen, you know, a lot of growth demographically, which is really kind of a hidden strength for us.
From all kinds
economically,
of countries.
But yeah, all kinds of countries.
Yes.
And for well over 100 years, you know, the American citizens have always resisted newcomers, whether it was the Chinese, East Europeans, anybody. Today it's, you know, Mexicans, but they've always resisted it. And it's always the American government elites that have kind of created a meta-narrative of city on a hill and inviting people to refurbish and renew the country economically and politically. And it really is a hidden strength for the U.S., I believe.
And long term, it's a strength insofar as a lot of economists and demographers say aging countries in Europe or Japan really need immigrants and immigration to bring young people so that they can pay for the Social Security and retirement of people who are aging. And it's the societies that are aging fast that are in economic trouble down the road. So that's actually people talk about the economic costs of immigrants to workers in the United States and so on. But one of their main and long-term and forthcoming benefits will be the fact that the United States is not aging out as though the big baby boom retirement.
And can help support the baby boomers in their retirement.
That's right.
We can only hope.
Yeah.
And energy and enthusiasm and all those other kinds of things are actually an economic positive about immigrants.
I would agree with Shelley and her comments about the melting pot being a strength, and it's both our strength and it's also a failure of our society today, where we're emphasizing cultural differences more than we're emphasizing our similarities or mutual interest, and that results in divided neighborhoods, cities, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Very similar in many cases to what you would see in a place like Bosnia, which erupted along sectarian lines and exploded into a civil war. You see what's happening in our inner cities today, where you have neighborhood class, economic class, genders, races, all fighting, whereas we don't emphasize enough what we need to do to be Americans and think at least along similar lines of what it means to be an American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there seems like there is so little emphasis that comes out in the news anyway about collaboration and so much more focus on the contentiousness, for lack of another word, that happens between people who have different thoughts, who could still have different thoughts and find a way to work together.
And to contribute.
And
right.
to contribute, right.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're going to take a call from John. And if you're interested in calling, you can call us at 805-781-3875. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. You had a comment or a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of take off on the American exceptionalism thing. I happen to be reading a book by Andrew Bacevich called The New American Militarism, Americans Are Seduced by War. And one of the points he makes in there that our conflicts around the world have not ended well for our military since arguably Korea. Also wanted to kind of take exception to the Lieutenant Colonel's discussion about how poorly we're funding military. Bacevich does a pretty good job of chronicling the size of our military relative to any other country around the world. And so it is maybe that military power isn't the solution, because we keep spending more and more and perhaps are getting less and less. And probably Iraq and Afghanistan are a really good example that mere power, military power, is not a replacement for political will and political power. We can continue to spend more and more and get less and less. There's really no political questioning of military power these days. You can't get elected by questioning our military power. And so it's really kind of what Eisenhower cautioned us about, the military-industrial complex. And so spending more and expecting us to be this a country around the world, the police world, is not a solution that's going to be successful, in my opinion. And I'd be interested to see what the Lieutenant Colonel has to say about spending versus our adversaries in any other country around the world.
Well, I partially agree with what you said about, you know, the efficiencies, and just spending more money is not necessarily the answer. I want to see us spending smarter, and you have to understand the labyrinth that exists in defense procurement and things like that, and the budgeting process is a nightmare to try to get through. Actual flexibility in military spending is really restricted because these contracts they let, and with the corporate, the military-industrial complex you talked about, they pretty much tie the knots of legislators. And what they've done, like if you want to build an airplane, they'll make sure that 40 states will have a piece in buying that airplane. So Congress has an interest in not canceling something that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Military frequently has weapon systems imposed on them that they don't want or quantities they don't need and not able to direct it towards a national strategy. And I think the biggest problem is we need a national strategy that's clear and it's consistent. And we don't have that. We have changes of regimes every 4 years. We change the face of the Congress every couple of years. The former Soviet Union or Russia, for instance, had the same foreign minister for 30 years. Their policies were the same. The defense minister stayed there. They had continuity. We're like a roller coaster.
Are you arguing that we should change the Constitution in a way? No, of course not.
I'm just making a comment that this is an advantage that they had in their procurement system, whereas we did not. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Well, sure. That's the efficiency of that, of communism, and, you know, the efficiency versus the efficacy of it. And I wouldn't support that at all. I don't think most Americans would either.
I don't think that's what Al was saying at all. So, John, thank you for your comments.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
So you, if you recently joined us and would like to hear this entire show, you can go to our website, kcbx.org/news-talk. You can do the drop-down and click on Central Coast Voices, and you should be able to hear that, according to Hank, within 13 hours. In fact, you can listen locally to any recorded KCBX programs at your leisure after they've been uploaded to our website. We have about 15 minutes left in today's show, and my guest, Al Fonzi II, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army retired, Shelley L. Hurt, Associate Professor at Cal Poly, and Robert Schaefer, on faculty at Cal Poly as Senior Sociology Scholar, where he teaches, are here with me in studio. If you have questions or comments, you're welcome to call us at 805-781-3875, and we're going to take a call with Kelly here. Hi, Kelly.
Yeah. Charlie Blair calling from Lompoc. You're talking about diversity and how just came from a meeting of the Lompoc Interfaith Alliance, where you have people from the various faith communities, Buddhist, Baha'i, Jewish, Muslim, mm-hmm. LDS, and various Christian to get together, and we're planning. We've done something for International Peace Day in the past, and our big thing coming up is on the Thanksgiving weekend, Tuesday of the Thanksgiving week, we have, for the last several years, there's been an interfaith service at the Methodist Church in Lompoc, and it's been very, recognizes what we have in common rather than what we used to kill each other in the past.
So what you're saying is there are distinct differences, and you're recognizing that, but you're looking for some kind of common thread.
Correct. Yeah, we look. Yeah, as I say, the interfaith concept is looking at, well, like the golden rule, mm-hmm. and love your neighbor as yourself are basically part of virtually all the faith traditions.
And you're thinking this could maybe apply to Congress and House of Representatives?
I wish they would, yeah. Yeah, concentrate on what they agree on, not what they're ready to kill each other over.
Well, hopefully not.
Of course, it does make for good headlines.
That's well, thank you for calling, though.
Okay, catch you later here.
All right, bye-bye. Okay. We had a caller who called in and asked, what can...
We do to end ethnic conflict.
Yeah, what can the U.S. do to end conflict in the U.S. and the world? There's a small question for you guys.
I would say one thing that we could do that kind of relates to one of the earlier callers is I think the United States could do more to really help promote education and health care, particularly in poor countries around the world, particularly where governments there are weak and not capable of providing much in the way of health care and education. And I think that the main reason to invest heavily in healthcare and education and to spend the money and engage nonprofits and NGOs in those activities as well, because they're kind of already doing that, is because if you can do that, then you can provide education for women, and then they stay in school longer, they delay marriage and so on, and that's good for women. And healthcare means that babies are grow up without dying of terrible diseases and so on, and so it promotes people so they can make choices about the world and about their lives, and actually promote economic development. So I think that the United States could do, that's a way to prevent the kind of marginalization and conflict where people are fighting over scarce resources in
Africa. The question, I just had a sign flashed up, that the question was for ethnic conflicts. Yeah. You know, what could we do? But we have our own ethnic conflicts here.
Not really, do we? I mean, do we really have ethnic conflicts? I don't think so.
No?
I mean, not on the level when we think about, but we don't have anything like that. And even if you think of, Chicago being the exception, you have decline of urban violence in all the major cities across the country, with Chicago as this blaring exception. And, mm-hmm. People are trying to understand why that is. But we can't make a kind of generalization based on that. There is a lot of ethnic conflict in the world, and that's, something that needs to be addressed.
So how would that be addressed?
Well, commenting on Shelley's comment, it depends on where you live. I was stationed in Massachusetts back in the 80s, and you go to Boston, that is a very provincial city. I mean, the people there's people who've never left Boston. They even make jokes about it. Here's the Charles River, and the next, you have Boston Harbor, Charles River, Boston in between the two. About 1 inch of a map is the rest of the United States, and you have the Pacific Ocean. I knew people who were in their 60s who never set foot outside the city, and ethnic neighborhoods are a reality there. They really are. I mean, I had a soldier who was Puerto Rican who went to Revere Beach, and the police had to escort him and his family because people didn't like the fact that a Puerto Rican was on their beach, not from their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But it's micro as compared to Bosnia and other places of the world. My main fear is with massive immigration and people not assimilating into an American idea, perhaps like my grandparents did, those ethnic conflicts are going to be emphasized more in the future. We need to get back to the idea of we're all Americans first, and whatever else is a secondary thing to your name.
How do we engage then if we're engaging in a global scope? How do we engage with other countries, or do we, in ethnic conflicts?
Well, I think part of it is to promote values that don't celebrate sectarianism. In Europe today, Europe has had many ethnicities for a long time, but many politicians are kind of mobilizing ethnic groups around separate identities in, England and Scotland and in Catalonia and the Walloons. And, there's a lot of people that are using the Lombard League in Italy. They want to mobilize ethnic identities as a way to, wrestle for political power and maybe secure states of their own, which means they could be prime minister and so on. I think that's actually a very bad turn of development. And that I think it's kind of hard to counter that and to say that, we're in the single garment of destiny that we share and that we have to inhabit a place collaboratively. And part of the thing is, Lincoln said, so you separate, one group says, we don't want to have anything to do with you, and we go off on our own. But what's to stop them from saying, the Confederacy goes, and then Texas saying, I don't want to be part of the rest of you guys, and then the people in Southern Texas saying, what's the end to it? Is that if you play that card and go in that sectarian, ethnic-oriented dimension, then Lincoln said the end is ruin, and I think that's a powerful force in the world today, is that kind of sectarian separatist mode, and I think that it's hard to counter, but I think it's important to do so.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have about 5 minutes, so I want to really give each of you a minute or two to just kind of, if you were to address something that you think really sticks out for you about what is America's role, what would you kind of as a summary give for that? Shelley, I'll start with you.
I think I would concentrate on people understanding that America is very powerful and influential, and to try to channel the energy of what can be the best and the goodness of America and the world, and for people to focus on that. And once they kind of recognize that the U.S. hasn't lost a lot of power and influence, that then they can try to fix things at home. Because I am concerned, as I mentioned earlier, about some of the political and economic dysfunction domestically. And I think that is something that we should focus more on and not worry as much about.
Do you have any ideas of how to get through that?
Well, it's funny. I was thinking when Al raised the excellent point about the inefficiencies of the Congress assembling a plane in 40 different locations so everybody can get some, you know, have their finger in the pie, as it were, everywhere. Yeah. This is a consequence of Congress outlawing earmarks. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that I think Americans sometimes don't think about, unintended consequences.
Yes.
And so we should start a campaign, bring earmarks back, right? Because if you actually had some way to grease the wheels of the political machinery, then things might operate more smoothly. Because something, the example about the plane being built in 40 locations, at least with earmarks, it would be built in 15 or 20 and not 40, and that it would actually be more efficient and get done at a better cost.
Right. How about for you, Al?
Well, I want just advise people in this election year, do not be swayed by the siren song of American withdrawal from the world or isolationism, because there's just a news report yesterday because of our – we broke Iraq, and as Colin Powell said, we now own it, except we don't own it because we gave it back in its condition. Yesterday, or on the news, they showed what happened in Sinjar province with ISIS there. They found mass graves. There's 14 different sites. The one that they were showing on the news was 600 feet long, 50 feet wide, and contained between 5,000 and 15,000 bodies. And we saw this in Bosnia. We did nothing. This kind of genocide is occurring repeatedly now, from the 90s onward, first in Rwanda and then in Bosnia. And now it's occurring in wholesale in Iraq. We have a moral responsibility to the world. We are the most powerful, most economically advantaged country in the world. I'd like to see us work more through non-government organizations, not necessarily governments, because NGOs, I think, are far more effective in their distribution of assistance than governments. But the world looks to us, to leadership still, and what's going to fuel arms races and future conflict is when they feel that America is no longer there. That's when you're going to see Saudi Arabia and other countries building nuclear weapons, and the world become a far more dangerous and more unstable place.
Thank you. In 1 minute,
yeah,
Robert.
I would just say I actually agree that the United States works best when we work with others and engage in cooperation, in collaboration, in military and economic alliances and trade agreements and so on, where you negotiate and work out with these things, and with people that you have implacable differences, you come together and collaborate in a NATO alliance to bring an end to genocides and or marginalizations or political turmoil or disaster relief.
And regardless of what happens in the election, we're still here in this country, and we still are faced with the same issues in November or January that we've got right now.
That's true.
And we all need to be conscious about how we're going to vote with that. So I thank all of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank
you. I want to thank Alfred J. Fongsi II, Lieutenant Colonel retired U.S. Army, Shelley L. Hurt, Associate Professor at Cal Poly Political Science Department, Robert Schaefer, who is Cal Poly as Senior Sociology Scholar, and everyone who called in with your comments and your questions. Next week, please join Fred Monroe. I'm sure he'll have a lively discussion for you. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Actually for Healthy Communities and San Luis Obispo Community Foundation and made possible by underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. I thank you for joining me. I'm Chris Kington Barker. You've been listening to Central Coast Voices.